why not have diverse people? Well, why have diverse people? It's because it is the engine to your creativity. Just think about it. If you have a bunch of homogenous people, you're going to have a bunch of homogenous ideas.
Welcome to Sidebars, Kilpatrick Townsend's limited podcast series focused on women in patent law. I'm April Isaacson, a patent litigator and partner in the San Francisco office.
And I'm Kim Davis, a patent prosecutor and partner in the Atlanta office. We're here to discuss the gender gap in the patent bar and have candid conversations with female patent practitioners on their career paths.
Welcome back to Sidebars. I'm April Isaacson. In this episode, Kim and I are interviewing Hong Nguyen. Hong has her BA in philosophy from UCLA, where she was a self-described lab rat who spent numerous hours working in the lab and taking advanced courses in biological sciences. She has her law degree from UC Hastings and is a member of the patent bar. Hong is currently general counsel and compliance officer at Fosun Pharma USA. She has been an attorney for 20 years and has more than a decade of experience as in-house counsel at pharmaceutical companies. As you will hear throughout this episode, Hong has an amazing journey, and Hong is many things. I am proud that I get to call Hong my friend. Hong Nguyen, welcome to Sidebars.
Thank you so much, April. Thank you so much, Kimberly, for inviting me.
Normally, we start out about asking how someone would pivot from science to law. But I know in your case that that's a very long answer and that your path was circuitous. So why don't we get started with your journey and how you came to the United States? As an eight-year-old, I saw in 1975 the fall of Saigon on TV, but you weren't able to be part of the airlift of helicopters in April of 1975. Can you talk about your journey to this country?
So my dad wanted the whole family to be airlifted, and somehow that didn't happen. And so he waited, and we didn't as a family leave at that time. He then, along with many other people in South Vietnam at that time, because they were on the losing side of the war, a lot of intellectuals, a lot of the southern, those who supported the American forces, mostly in the southern part of Vietnam, were placed in what's called re-education camps, basically trying to get them to rethink their thoughts about communism, which I don't think worked, but I think it's a form of punishment for those people who supported the American forces. In any event, my dad was put in a camp for a number of years and was released, I don't know when, but when he was released, he made sure that we did not live there anymore because he did not support the ideology or, you know, anything relating to do with communism. So we tried to escape, like a host of other people, hundreds and thousands of people really leaving, you know, leaving Vietnam because they did not support communism. And we were in that sort of stream of refugees leaving Vietnam. And one of the ways in which you can, I think the majority way that you can leave Vietnam at that point is just sort of just to get a boat and float into international water, hopefully pray that you get picked up by vessels that are from the United States or from Germany or from France or wherever. And they take pity on you and they drop you off at a refugee camp. And that's the hope for a lot of these refugees from Vietnam. And my dad at that time owned a fishing boat. And he and a bunch of other people, including my two older sisters, hopped on a boat in 1977, something like that, a couple years after the fall of Vietnam. And they left Vietnam. And my brother, my younger brother, me, and my mom somehow did not make it on that boat. So they floated out into international waters, was picked up by a French vessel, and then dropped off at a refugee camp. And at that point, they were sponsored by a Catholic church in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And he left the refugee camp with my sisters and went to Green Bay, Wisconsin, where the church was located. My mom, my brother, and I tried to escape a couple more times and was unsuccessful. We were, you know, placed in refugee camps and then repatriated to Vietnam. But the third time, we ran out of money. And also, you know, the adults at that time thought that they would help my mom out by, you know, taking one of the kids away, because at that point she did not have a husband and she had two young kids to take care of. And they wanted to relieve her of that responsibility. And since I was the older child at that time, I believe I was 5 and my brother was 2 at the time. So instead of him, they picked me. And so I went home with my 2 aunts and cousin. The third time, which was successful, we floated out into international waters. But before we got to a refugee camp, we were boarded by pirates from Thailand. And at that time, when people leave Vietnam, they would bring all of their possessions in terms of jewelry and money. And so if you have a boat full of people with jewelry and money in a climate such as that, people are going to go out there and try to take it. And so we had a lot of robbers on the sea, which, you know, robbers on the seas are pirates. So they would board these boats and they would rob them. And sometimes, you know, they would rape the women and throw them overboard. Now, luckily, we were robbed before we were picked up by another vessel. But we were robbed, and an interesting story came out of it. I remember sort of hearing all this commotion and suddenly my aunt taking her diamond ring and sticking it into my mouth. And I just sat there and didn't really know what was going on. And I just remember hearing sort of commotion coming closer to me. And then at one point I saw my other aunt, her jade bracelets on both sides of her arms are broken and taken. And I just froze. And then, you know, and then they left. I don't remember exactly everything that happened, but I remember after when they left, you know, my aunt, we stuffed the ring in my mouth, took it out. And that ring allowed us in the next refugee camp that we went to, allowed us to buy a month's worth of food there. So it was, in a way, lucky that she did that. But I think it was kind of frightening for a buddy who was, you know, 5 years old and had a ring in their mouth and pirates coming and trying to take those types of things away. So we landed at a refugee camp and we contacted my dad, and my dad was able to sponsor us, and we left and I came to Green Bay, Wisconsin. And my mom and my brother came 8 years later. Well, actually, my mom and my brother came eight years later. And at that time, when we all left, my mom remarried for economic reasons. I think she was like wife number 5 or 6 or whatever from just so that she can support her child. And then she had my half brother. And, you know, her life is pretty interesting because she's giving up her kids in different parts of her life. So when she came, my half brother's dad did not want him to come. So he didn't come until much later, 6 or 7 years after that. So my whole family came in for shipments. And we didn't get reunited till really much longer, until I was in college, actually, because I remember my first wife and I trying to file the paperwork to get my half-brother over here. So yeah, that's how I came to the United States.
So Hong, you were what was referred to as the Vietnamese boat people.
Yes.
Talk to us about your journey in terms of coming to the United States and having your family separated, as you were discussing earlier.
It was really interesting. I think a lot of my memories of what happened is somewhat informed by, you know, what people have told me later on. Because when it was happening, nobody really sat down. I mean, no adult really sat down and had a conversation with me about what was going on. I mean, I think the idea was just, you know, you're 5 or 6 years old and what's there to talk about? Or we don't want to talk about anything scary. You know, we don't want to say, okay, we're going to bring you out in the water and you might be boarded by, you know, our ship might be boarded by pirates. I think those types of discussions might have scared some of the adults away from actually talking about it to little kids. But I think now that I look back at it, it would have been good for them to have told me something that was age appropriate, because I really, you know, I was very confused and very, but never said anything because it was like my parents and they, I just thought they had my best interests in mind. So I didn't question anything, but it was very confusing. And I remember thinking, why isn't that I couldn't talk to my mom after I came to Green Bay, Wisconsin? I remember thinking about that, but never had a real conversation with my dad. And what I learned later on was that my dad was in contact with my mom at that time, and that why they didn't feel the need to have me talk to my mom or even write to her was kind of odd. You know, I don't, whatever they decided, they decided. But I didn't really get a chance to talk to my mom. I think in my mind, she passed away the first time. Metamorphically in my mind, like she's gone. That person was gone when I was 5 years old, when she gave me to my aunt to take me to the United States. And that person came back into my life when I was 14 years old. And that time I spoke very little English. I mean, very little Vietnamese. She spoke no English and we didn't talk about it. And this person who showed up was supposedly my mom, but not really my mom. And so it's an odd type of relationship where you in your head, that's your mom, but you don't feel anything really toward her because you're missing big chunks of that bonding time when you're young. So that was difficult to reestablish that relationship. And my mom and dad had passed already, but I don't think I ever reestablished my relationship with my mom ever because of, as a teenager, you're kind of in your own world. And we had a huge language barrier at that point. So I didn't initiate, getting to know her, but she didn't do the same thing with me either. So it was just sort of like, oh yes, you're my mom. Okay, let's try to get back as a family. And remember that time my mom was married to somebody else too. So it was kind of an odd situation, where she came to the United States and somehow we're a family again. And the nothing it was discussed with the kids. I'm sure they had long conversations with each other. But yeah, that was difficult trying to reestablish those relationships.
Well, and she was your biological mother, but in a way, a stranger.
Absolutely.
Hung, you raised such a good point about communicating with children and letting them know at a level that's appropriate for them what's going on. And in particular, I wonder about your approach, and if you wouldn't mind chiming in on that. I know your children are older, but the current climate within the AAPI community, even, are you very open? Is your position that we should let our children know exactly what's going on at a level that they can understand? Would that better serve them?
I think, Kimberly, you raise a really good point. I mean, you as a Black woman in the Black community, you've had to face those kinds of questions when there are shootings, right?
Yes, in your
community. And you have kids too, and you question like how much is appropriate to talk to kids about. And our family has always been open, 100% open about what's going on. And it's just a level of conversation that we want to provide for our kids. You just kind of have to kind of gauge your kids' level of understanding and how sensitive they are to certain types of facts that you provide to them. I know that one of my kids is very cerebral, so we can have policy conversations. We had long conversations about, Black Lives Matter and police violence and all that stuff. And my other one, who's, 2.5 years younger, he's so sensitive. He has such a big heart that we talk about in such general terms, like we don't have deep conversations. But, both of them, we have to talk about those issues because that's their lives. So with respect to, the anti-Asian hate going on, it's interesting with them because they're, we, my first wife and I, we decided to have biological kids. So we went through a sperm bank. And the donor is half Mexican and half Chinese. And my first wife is, Swedish. And so they're half Swedish, a quarter Mexican, quarter Chinese. If you look at them, they look more white than anything else. So it's interesting them growing up to see what sort of identity they own. The two most prevalent identities, white and Asian, right? Mm-hmm. Because we don't have any sort of Mexican, you know, heritage to provide to them. Because I give them, you know, the Asian part, and my first wife gives them the Swedish part. And each one of them deals with identity of race slightly differently. So, and it changes as they age. You know, are they more Asian? I know when I was with, because right now we're separated by the coast. So I live on the East Coast and they live in the West Coast. And I've been here a year and we haven't been seeing them as much because of COVID. But I know that when I was with them in the West Coast, they would spend part of the day with me, part of the week with me, and part of the week with my wife. They so very much identify as Asian, right? When I was there. And now that they live in a fully Swedish household for a long time, they might identify more as white. But I know that we've had conversations, gay rights, conversations right when they were born. I remember Prop
87. Was that the one you were thinking about? Or Proposition 8 is what you were thinking about.
So both propositions, mm-hmm. right? But mostly Proposition 8. You know, my first wife was very involved in that. And she helped organize the faith community. And he, you know, my first son at that time was, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And he was well aware of what was going on. And we had to have those conversations with him why certain parts of California didn't want his family to have, you know, equal rights. And so we had those conversations. So it kind of then just sort of, so conversations about BLM and police brutality and stuff just sort of is a natural discussion for our family.
And for those listeners that aren't aware, Proposition 187 was back in 1994, and it was about rights for children of what would be considered undocumented immigrants to California. And then Prop 8 was about same-sex marriage in California. No, it's interesting, Hong, that you say that, because as you know, and I know as Kim knows, my brother, he's my biological brother, so he's white. His wife has a father from Mexico, and her mother was Chinese-American. So my nieces have the same issues with identity, whether they identify as Latina or Chinese American or white. And you're right, the nuances of that change over time as they grow up. So it's a really interesting point. Can you talk about, I know you've mentioned a little bit about things related to your family, and you and I have spent a lot of time, we worked together as in-house counsel for a few years, and spent a lot of time talking to each other about family situations. I know that you would, I think, consider your family to be dysfunctional, as I do mine. Can you talk about how that's affected you as a person and some of the things that you've done to overcome what I would consider adversities you've faced?
So my dad, when I say, you know, my family is dysfunctional, it's not sort of like a blame, it's sort of objective. I mean, they've gone through a lot of trauma. And because of that, they've reacted in certain ways and acted in certain ways. And I've, over the years, come to sort of not accept it, but just been like, well, that's the way it is. Not excuse it, not judge it as much, because judging requires a lot of energy on my part. And you can't change any of that. So, you know, why judge that? So when I was living in Green Bay, Wisconsin, my dad was sort of a single parent at that time. And he was looking, you know, in his mid-30s with three daughters under the age of, you know, 10 or 12 that he had to take care of. And he was not proficient in language. And he had really no skills to offer. You know, he had skills, but not without any language to that. And so I think he was really frustrated. And I'm sure, you know, he experienced a lot of trauma coming over here. So all of that really caused him to become an alcoholic and relied on, you know, alcohol to sort of escape some of what he was feeling. But because of that, he really didn't take care of us. You know, he would be physically violent to us, toward the kids. He really didn't, really, other than provide, you know, shelter, rarely was there enough food and all the stuff. So we really had to take care of our own by ourselves. You know, or we were latchkey kids and we had to really fend for ourselves. And my two sisters were much older than me. And so they were much more, you know, they hung out together more. And I was just left mostly alone. So my upbringing really affected, you know, me and how I function. I just feel like I always never want to be reliant on anybody for economic means, because that will give them too much control over me. For me, you know, if I wanted to do something, I needed to make that happen. My parents weren't going to help me. Nobody else was going to help me. So if I wanted something to happen, it would have to come from me. You know, and if things didn't happen, well, I didn't do it. You know, I didn't make that happen. So those two things are really huge. The third thing that is huge, and I think a lot of people feel this way, is that they feel they have a second lease in life. They're given this opportunity, whether you believe in a higher power and what the higher power looks like. I mean, I truly believe I had a second opportunity to live when I came here in the United States, and I didn't want to squander that opportunity, because there are many, many other people that could have been in my shoes. And so with that, I feel like life is just amazing here in the United States. Even though we have some issues that we have to deal with, this is a fantastic opportunity. I don't want to waste it.
Can you talk about what it was like as a child to come to the United States with English as your second language and then go to school here?
Well, so in Greenbrook, Wisconsin, at that time, there was no ESL programs. So what they did with me is they just put me in the slow learner classes for the longest time. And I thought to myself, hey, I'm not a slow learner necessarily. I just don't know English. So that kind of affected me. But then I, you know, looked around and realized, you know, if I wanted to be respected in school, I needed to do well. So when I started learning English and got a better hold of English, I think in fourth grade, I remember thinking to myself, like, I'm going to get good grades because I need to be respected. And you would only get respected as a student if you got good grades. That's what I thought. I mean, of course, you know, you're respected. You should be just respected because you're a person. But that's what I thought. And also because I didn't know English that well, even after fourth grade, I really never really thought humanities or law or anything like that would be something that would be in my future. Because if you rely on like engineer or being a doctor or the sciences, you don't need English that much. So I think a lot of immigrants come over here and they're like, okay, here's what you can choose from. You can be an engineer, you can be a doctor, or you can be a scientist. Yeah, those types of things don't require a lot of English, you know, for you to succeed in. And so I just never thought anything in the humanities or law would be something in my future.
So Hong, can you tell us a little bit more about the classroom setting? I'm very intrigued by what you said in terms of being treated better because of your grades. I think that still holds true today that we see. And I also believe that a lot of it has to do with certain variables in a child's life. I have a very, very diverse school that I send my sons to, and I've just noticed certain dynamics and as they vary based on the populations. We'll leave it at that. So what's your advice to these students and even to our listeners who involve themselves in the education space when they are advocating for children who, as you did, had so much trauma in your formative years? How do you successfully help such a child to succeed even despite everything that they faced at that point?
Well, my second wife, who's my current wife, is an educator. She's been a classroom teacher for 20 years, and now she works at a gaming company, an educational gaming company. And what I've learned a lot is, you alluded to it in terms of the composition of the students in a school, but really at the end of the day, it's the composition of the teachers. The majority of the teachers are white women. They don't get paid a lot, and they spend a god-awful amount of time doing it, and they spend their own money trying to support the classroom. But the problem is, you have a homogenous group of people teaching who don't necessarily have the right the training in trauma or the training in cultural sensitivities to these populations that are different, right, from their own upbringing. I'm sure they do perfectly fine with kids who have similar upbringings as them. But so they're not given trauma training. right? Or they're not giving cultural training. So I remember this is quite benign, but I remember my kids will be treated, if my kids went to or is in private school. And I remember telling the teacher, put some rules. If you need to yell at him, yell at him. This is what we do at home. And it's no problem. I don't see this behavior at home. But they were so sensitive because that's not how they were brought up. They were brought up to talk to kids, or they were trained to talk to kids in a just deliberate and calm manner, which is great. But sometimes a kid just needs to, nope.
There you go.
That's cultural training.
Yes.
Right? If an Asian parent comes to you and says, if you need to talk sometimes like that to the kids in order for them to comply, that's what you do, right? And as a teacher, you should change the way you approach it. And also number one is, God, these kids from inner city, these kids coming in from the boats, they have so much trauma.
Yes.
And so you just have to learn with how, you know, sometimes they, oh my God, I will tell you, Cameron, I must have been terrible as a child, you know, because I can't imagine in school, I can't imagine going through all of that and not acting out in any way. Mm-hmm. I think I did. I'm sure I did. I was beat up for being Asian because I was, you know, the only Asian around. And then when I got enough wherewithal, I was like, you're not beating me up. I'm kicking your ass. And so I became sort of a bully in that process.
Well, so I have to add in there, for those of you who do not know Hong, she is 5 feet tall. And when I first had her in my car in the front seat, the airbag sensor went off because they thought I had a child in the front seat. So she's a small little thing, but she is a force of nature.
It's because I learned as a child, nobody's going to stand up for me. And there's certain things that kids won't cross, right? If mm-hmm. if they feel like they're going to bully you and they're going to get something back, they're not going to bully you. So at some point as a kid, I know you as a parent, you would never say, okay, beat them up. But, you know, sometimes in the playground, you have playground rules.
That's right.
And you just have to draw that line. But in any event, you know, going back to your question, Kimberly, it's not just the makeup of the students. It's really the makeup of the educator that really counts. And I think we have a crisis right now in teaching. We don't pay people enough money. And because of that, they don't have enough time, enough training and all this stuff. And so it's just a bigger issue.
Well, and going back to your playground time of kind of asserting yourself, I know you and I have talked in the past about athletics and how it got you out of the house. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So the first time I can join teams, I did. I played volleyball, basketball, and softball all throughout my whole time. And not because I was really, really interested in all of that. It's because I needed to get out of the house. Like, my house was just miserable. I mean, that's just objective, right? I'm not complaining about it, but it's just a miserable place to be. And I'd rather be with other friends, other coaches. You know, April, I know you mentioned that the people who raised you were really your coaches and your friends' parents and teachers. And, you know, it takes sort of like a village to raise kids who don't have that support at home.
Absolutely.
And so it was the same with me. And I relied a lot on academics to sort of be respected, but also relied on athletics just to get out of the house. Not because I think at 5 feet I'm gonna be this amazing athlete when I grow up. Because I did stop growing in middle school or something like that. So I never had grand thoughts of being an athlete. But that was always something that I relied on. And now that as an adult, I think that I also relied on athletics to help me with a lot of the trauma symptoms that I was feeling. Because I think that being tired and having endorphins and all the stuff really helped calm my system in such a chaotic place. So I felt that so not athletics to me was really key to keeping sanity and keeping me through those stages in my life.
And also helping you find your tribe, so to speak, in terms of the support that you mentioned.
Oh, 100%. Like, I had three teams. If you wanted to beat me up, you're going to have to beat up all my three teams. You know what I'm saying? It's like nobody bothered me. Nobody bothers you if you have a team and a group of people who are going to have your back all the time. So I remember going through school, I was one of those, you know, scholarly athletes, like, and left alone. I was left alone because I wanted to be alone, because I always felt different in different ways. And we can talk about that later. But, you know, after getting beaten up as a young one, and then joining, you know, athletics, those people protected me. So I never felt picked on at all growing up because of athletics.
Hong, I know you and I are both veterans, and I'd like you to talk about your experience in the military, because I know it was a very unique situation.
Yeah. So all throughout school, I just, you know, elementary, middle, and high school, I just never felt like this was my life or this was my family. And things that were happening to me, I knew they were wrong, you know, a lot of them. So I never really sort of pointed that kind of stress back at me, like what's wrong with me? Why is this happening to me? You know, why am I getting beat up or whatever? Like, it was like, no, this is wrong. This shouldn't happen. And when I have the opportunity to, I'm going to take off. Which is when you graduate from high school, you can take off at 18. So that was my goal. My goal was basically to buy my time, do whatever I can do to help myself jump to the next stage and just not be where I was going to be. And so I just remember this one day, a couple months prior to graduation, a military recruiter came to my high school, and he wanted to talk with all the athletes, because of course, you know, it's a good group of kids to sort of talk to join the military. And his pitch was pretty amazing to me at that time. Hey, come join the military. We'll pay for your education and you can go almost anywhere in the world you want. And so I thought, oh, that's a great pitch. You know, I'm ready to go. And so I joined. And right after graduation, I went to boot camp in Fort Leonard Wood. At that time, we call it Fort Lost in the Wood, because it's like 40 miles from St. Louis. And if you wanted to like leave, you couldn't, because there are so much woods. You can't just leave. So I got shipped there. And really, I don't know with you, April, but I really loved the military because it provided such stability.
Absolutely. You
know, exactly.
And structure. And camaraderie.
Exactly. All of those things that had been missing in my life. I was like, oh my God. And the rules. I mean, if these are the rules, if you didn't follow it, here's what would happen. If you follow it, here's what would happen. There's no chaos. You know?
Exactly. And I will say, Hong and I are always early because of our experience in the military.
That's right. So it was such serenity. Like, it was so peaceful. People are like, oh, the military, that's so terrible. I'm like, oh my God, it's so peaceful. I know exactly what to do, how to succeed. And it's my choice, you know, and what the steps I need to do to succeed. It was just all laid out. So I loved it.
Well, and part of it is too, you and I didn't have structure growing up because of our family situation. And now you're in this opportunity where you're functioning as a unit and you have this structure that you and I really thrived for.
Yeah. And both of us, you know, coming out of chaos and coming and joining the military, I think that was one of the best things for me at that time, because I just felt like, oh, this is the place that I want to be for long term. And so I had this like 20-year plan when I was, you know, 18 years old. 20-year plan is like, you know, I would join the military, have them pay for my schooling, have them pay for my medical school, and then just be a medical doctor in the medical corps of the Army for 20 years, get my pension, leave, and then open, you know, a clinic for disadvantaged people. And that was my 20-year plan at 18 years old. And of course,
but that was derailed.
That was derailed. Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I, you know, growing up, I always felt different. I know I just couldn't put my finger on how. I just never felt like I fit in any group, or I just, you know, never felt really close, super close to anybody growing up because I never felt like I fit in. And then I became what's called an RA, a resident assistant in the dorms, and was exposed to gay culture. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm gay. You know, it took like this much. I mean, it's very quick. It's like, oh, I get it. I get it now. All right. And then it was quick for me personally to come out. But at that time, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was in place. And basically, you know, I struggled with being gay with the policy at that time. When I joined in 1992, policy actually wasn't the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It was, if you're gay, we're going to kick you out. What I found out later was that that would have been found unconstitutional. And so what happened was supposed to be a quote-unquote compromise, but it was really deceitful. So the compromise was, you can be gay, but your gay conduct is what's going to get you booted from the military. So basically, you can be celibate. We won't kick you out because of your status, but we'll kick you out because of your conduct. And your conduct is what's causing the low morale and the chaos in the military. We don't like your conduct.
Well, and you know, I was in during that time of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and it was, and I had to give legal advice to people. And basically on a high level, it was, yes, the status of being gay, you had to keep it to yourself. Everyone had to be closeted. And if you were caught, quote, in the act, which could be someone seeing you at dinner with someone of the same gender, then you might be reported. And then there would be potential disciplinary action, which I know ended up being the case for you, but you really took the reins here in terms of how you wanted to live your authentic life. If you can talk about that.
Yeah. So I thought, oh, I just left this chaos. And I'm at a place where I have control. And then now, because I realize that I'm gay, I have no longer any control over my personal and professional life because of this policy. And so I kind of knew the consequences, but I just felt like I just couldn't live under a policy that at any moment could, you know, my career could be taken away from me. You know, it's very deceitful. It's not that you can't tell, but no, like somebody can tell on you. You can keep quiet, but somebody can tell on you. And then there goes your problem. And I've heard stories, just terrible stories, where people are in it for 19 years and they're waiting for their last year and somebody, you know, tells on them because they, you know, they want revenge or something and they lose their pension.
Oh, what? Gosh.
Imagine that. After 19 years, it's gone.
That happened to someone at my command who was a senior chief, which means a very senior enlisted person who was 1 year from his pension. And then he was outed by someone. And that's exactly what happened to him, which was absolutely heartbreaking to see. Yeah. Wow, Hong. It's just amazing to hear your story. And can you talk about how that changed your path at UCLA?
Yeah. So at UCLA at that time, all the colleges had this debate, because they have this non-discrimination policy that includes sexual orientation. And they also supported ROTC on campus. They supported them with, you know, offices and money and stuff like that. And so the question was, how can you be a university that supports this non-discrimination policy, but still support an organization like the military that explicitly discriminates against gay people? And so there was a huge debate at that time going on campus. And my case, when I came out, really caused a whirlwind. And we believe that it caused the enactment of what's called the Solomon Amendment, which says that if you kick ROTC off campus, the military can take all the money back from its contracts. So for instance, for a university like UCLA, that's a lot of federal contracts money that will be taken away from you if you kick ROTC off campus. So they're kind of stuck between a rock and hard place with me. But so what happened when I got kicked out is I spent a quarter not knowing how am I going to sort of support myself and get back to school. And what they did was they had a policy that said that if there was any cadet that was like me that was going through that process, they would get enough money together and help me out. And that's what they did, was to give me some grant money to get back into school. And I finished school 5 years later, not later, but 5 years, and then I went off to law school. But that was a really interesting time because I think that was sort of my first adult decision that I made. Like, I will not compromise me because I've worked like too hard to get to this point, and I can't live in a compromised way. And so that was sort of my first adult decision to say, I'm taking matters back into my own hands, despite what's going on around me.
And now we pivot to how you went from science to law. Can you talk about how that happened at UCLA? Because I know, like Kim and me, you had originally wanted to be a doctor, but obviously you're a lawyer now. Talk right. about that path.
And that's related to getting booted from the military, because going back to my 20-year plan, that wasn't going to happen. And, you know, I think that when people go through these big life changes, at least for me, and it's happened a few times in my life, and I've looked back, and this is what happens. Chaos is going around you, and you look down, and like everything is moving under you. So you have sort of earthquake under you, and you have your hurricane around you. I become very zen about it because I'm like I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to put my foot down in the earth and have that shake me, and I'm not going to like have the wind shake me. So I'm just going to be zen about it for a moment. I'm going to take advantage of this chaos that's like happening around me. And I think at that point, I took the chaos and I thought, hey, is it really okay? I mean, do I really want to be a doctor still? Do I still want to pursue this even if I don't have the support of the military? And I thought to myself, no, I don't want to, because I'm really not good with patients. You know, I don't have good bedside manners. I really hate to be around people who are suffering because I'm very sensitive. And so I just feel like I don't think being a doctor would be a good long-term thing for me. And I thought, okay, so if I don't want to be a doctor, maybe I could be a scientist. But I had been a lab rat for like 4 years and really did not like that life, because for some people, it's great life. You go into the office at 6 a.m, you do your experiments, you know, you have one or two other people around you, you listen to, you know, talk radio and country music all day long. And then you leave at the end of the day. And then maybe your result from the day before was good. And if it was bad, you just toss it. And you did this year in and year out. This is a scientist. I applaud every scientist who makes yes. an amazing contribution to science, because I think about all the days that they had to spend. Imagine Mendel and his freaking peas. How many peas did he have to write down? And there was no computer. You have to write down all those peas, all two different colors, if I mix this and that, all the nights. That good thing he was kind of monkish in that way. But like all that work. So it wasn't me. I needed to like talk to people at least. And so I thought, oh, how about law? And I thought, oh, that's a terrible idea. I don't really know how to speak English and I don't write that well. But then I talked to some of my family members. They're like, law makes perfect sense. You argue with us all the time growing up. Like, you'd argue on everything. Why not? And I thought, yeah, why not? And the only thing holding me back at that point was me. Why not? Because if I put in the hours to learn English better and to write better, why not? Right? So that's what I did. I switched to philosophy, which was crazy at that point because I had been a lab rat for 3 years and only was writing lab reports. And now I had to write philosophy papers about, I mean, seriously, we spent a whole quarter on like a page of Descartes the first day. I thought, what the hell is this? What classes I choose? I think, therefore I am. How much can you talk about I think, therefore I am?
Like, yeah. And Bonhoeffer and Buber as well.
That's right.
Oh, gosh.
But I said, okay, I have to do it. I have to go through this process because I didn't do it for the first 3 years and I need this in order to get into law school and do well. And so I read a ton of books. I'm telling you, that year, I just said, okay, I need to read books. So I read a bunch of sci-fi, like a bunch of science fiction because I was like, at least I'm interested in that topic. And then it had to be good writers, right? Because it's not like all science fiction writers are good writers. So my first art really is a science fiction fanatic. And so she like turned me on to a bunch of stuff. And I just remember the series, the Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars. It's the terraforming of Mars. It's amazing. It's a great book. I just read a lot of sci-fi in that year and the few years there. And so that's my pivot actually was like getting booted from the military and really at that point thinking, what do I want to do at this point?
Hong, I love that philosophy, the why not philosophy. How do you live that philosophy in the workplace today as general counsel?
I think that has given me more creativity in the ways that I try to counsel my clients because a lot of times people, and this is my pet peeve, when lawyers and the other side said, this is what we've done in the past and we're going to do this, not thinking why you're doing this. I got to say, just like yesterday, I was talking to my business development person and she's for another company, not at Fosun, for another company that I represent. And we were looking at a term sheet and there was all this like in a non-binding term sheet, this huge indemnification and reps and warranty. I'm like, why is this on the non-binding term sheet? Why? Because this should be in the definitive. And she said, well, that's how we did it at App. And I'm like, I don't care. That's not a reason. I know that's how you did it, but that's not the reason to do it in non-binding term sheet. Why? It's not binding. The only two things that are binding in this non-binding term sheet is the confidentiality and the governing law. Why are we spending so much time right now going back on this? So I think that the why not really helps me to say into every decision I make, like, is this reasonable? Just, is this reasonable? Mm-hmm. And not rely on what happened in the past. Because you rely on what happened in the past, you can't ask, why not? Why can't we do something different? Why can't we do something that makes sense for us? You know? And so I think when I bring that into my practice as general counsel, when I ask, why not? Why not do that?
And I know from working with you, we always talked about having a practical approach to things. But one of the other things we talked about a lot and put into practice is the importance of diversity in the legal teams. Can you talk about your philosophy in that regard?
Yeah, again, it's kind of related to what Kimberly's saying. Why not? Why not have diverse people? Well, why have diverse people? It's because it is the engine to your creativity. Just think about it. If you have a bunch of homogenous people, you're going to have a bunch of homogenous ideas. And it's going to be like over and over again. And then it's like nobody sticks up and says, well, why we continue to do this? Because nobody has a different idea. So diversity, to me, is not just a moral or ethical issue. Putting that aside, it's a business issue because we as lawyers are problem solvers. And so in order to bring something to the table, we need to bring really good problem-solving skills and ideas, different ideas that can work at that time. And so diversity, to me, feeds into the creativity and problem-solving of a company.
Can you explain to those folks that have never been in-house how important it is, the pitch teams, and then seeing that through in terms of the diversity?
Well, think about it. We always say the first impression is everlasting, right? I mean, think about it. You're bringing in a team to represent your company. If you bring in a team that is all very homogenous, is that representative of your company, right? And is that what you want to say about how creative your team is, right? And so when you bring in a pitch team, you should have diverse people, not just diversity in terms of race or sexual orientation or gender, but like ability, you know, like all kinds of things. You should take into consider all kinds of diversity because, gosh, a person who is differently abled, oh my God, they see the world so, so much more different than we do. And so they can have creative solutions to our issues, that we don't even think about. And so when I say diversity, I know the first thing you guys, I know the first thing generally people think about is, you know, gender, sexual orientation, and race, but it's beyond that. It should be beyond that, but you should think about those things. And you, when you bring them in, don't let them just sit there. If you bring them in, you let them sit there and they don't participate in your conversation, that's terrible. That's worse than not bringing them in at all, right? Because then people are like, oh, you're just bringing in because, you know, you're trying to trick us. So they have to be not only talking in the pitch, they also have to be part of the team that you're trying to get the work. So yes, Jeannie is going to be talking in the pitch about what she's going to be doing for your case, for your matter. So all of that is important. And that is all to say, you know what? If you don't do it, at least in my book, you might not have the edge at the end of the day. There are so many good law firms out there who can meet your budget, who has the skill, who can fit what you're looking for. And so if you have a handful of companies who can do that, how are you going to distinguish yourself? So the one way for me, at least for me, to distinguish yourself is, yes, we can do all that like the other firm, but we'll be very creative. We'll be very creative is because we have a creative, a diverse team. And I use that as a tiebreaker.
And Kim and I have talked about the tokenism, right? Some people think, yeah, you just put someone on there and they check the box. But the in-house counsel look at the bills and they know who's doing the work.
Yeah. I mean, for in-house counsel who don't work in the area, I mean, I don't want to use the word play, but you can kind of shade. I mean, if you are like April and I, when we were in-house and we're overseeing litigation, you can't pull anything on us. We look at the bill and we say, oh, you spent 40 hours on an answer? No. No, we're not paying you 40 hours for the answer unless there was inequitable conduct and you have to do research on it. And there isn't. So too bad. No 40 hour hours for you. So, yeah, I mean, we really, for those of us who have practiced before in that area, you can't really, what you want to do as a outside counsel is to make your in-house counsel's life much easier. That's your main goal, really. And to do that, you want to offer practical business solutions to whatever issue you're working on.
Hung, for outside counsel, just another tip from you. What else can we do for our in-house counsel to make your life easier or better? What about promotion, so to speak? Is that helpful in any way, the same way it would be helpful for law firm attorneys to be promoted by their clients? Can we help in that way?
The opposite?
Yes, yes. Oh. Is there some kind of reciprocal relationship there?
Not really, because we're paying you, right? Of course you're going to sing our praises. And so that's kind of artificial, right? But it does work the opposite. We're paying you and we think you do really good work. And then we say something that works, I think, much better. So the way that I help out with that is that for younger associates or younger partners, whenever there's a review, I would try to put in a good word for that partner or younger associate, because I know that will help them out in their career. And I've done that a couple times and that's really helped out. And so I try to do my best to sort of help with the promotion part, you know, on the other end, because I know how it works on the other end.
Hong, I know how important your family is to you and your kids. Can you talk about that with us a little bit?
Yeah, my kids are my pain in the ass. I say that jokingly and realistically, they are a pain in the ass. But like, I love them so much. They're really the reason why I wake up and I work every day is because I know that I'm supporting them through school or through life or whatever. I want to be able to be there for them. I don't want them to, you know, have to go through what I had to go through. And so I always, you know, I tell them, you know, I'll be there. Even if you go to prison, I'll visit you, you know, like just to say that to them. And because then they'll know, okay, well, there's nothing I can do that can lose that love for my parent, right? I also tell them, you know, like, if you do something bad, I'm going to call the cops. Like, come on. but I'll visit you in jail.
Like, she has no nonsense. I will tell our listeners that don't know her. This is Hong.
Like, I will visit you in prison every single day and send you care packages, but do not, like, don't do shit. And if I know about it, you're going to suffer the consequences for it. But I love my kids. And that's how, you know, I don't know. I think it's because the way I was brought up, like I really didn't have a lot of guidance from my parents for whatever reason. I just want to be their guide. At this point, I'm not really like their day-to-day parent anymore. And in some ways that's a good thing because they're like flying the coop right now and I won't be suffering as much because my role will be almost the same right now for the rest of their lives. I'll call them up and I'll talk to them and they'll visit me sometimes. So it's pretty much kind of what, you know, what's my relationship with them is not going to change right now. You know, my first wife, they live with my first wife. So she's going to have to go through that hump of like, oh, I'm going to lose my children right now. Okay. Well, the reason I say they're a pain in my ass is they're lovely, but they've been very high maintenance in terms of education. They have had a lot of learning differences that we've had to scaffold tremendously. I just tell you this, you know, how people say like, however you're going to interact and react during kindergarten may affect the rest of your education. Well, my first child who's 18 right now, in his kindergarten year, he went to 4 years of Montessori preschool. And so we had no idea what was going on because in Montessori preschool, you get to do whatever you want anytime that you want. And so he went to traditional kindergarten. And in traditional kindergarten, he just couldn't deal with the format of it. Mm-hmm. So he basically checked out and rebelled. And we're like paying all this money for him to half the year sit with a head. We're like, oh my God, we're going to be kicked out of this school. they're not going to invite us back. And the other half of the year, we kind of like tried to bring him back into the classroom. And all he did was like, nope, I'm just going to sit here and draw robots with white paper and a pencil. If you give me anything else, I'm going to rebel and go back to the principal's office. Like, he would have lunch with the principal. I'm like, so that was sort of what happened the beginning of his education. And we just threw whatever we can. And we're lawyers. So we're like, okay, how do we fix this? Educational therapists, occupational therapists, you know, all kinds, tutors, all kinds of, you know, people that can help him. Because as lawyers, we're like, there is no way our child will hate school. That is the number one thing we cannot happen. They cannot hate learning. We both love learning. And if they hate learning, then this is a huge problem throughout their whole school. So we didn't care about the grades. We didn't care about friends. We didn't care about anything. We're like, please do not hate school. Please do not hate learning. And so that was our mantra. And amazingly, he took off. The 18-year-old took off and the 16-year-old is hopefully taken off soon. But the 18-year-old just got accepted to USC and the gaming department there, which is supposedly the best gaming department in the country. And I'm so proud, not because he got into USC and we didn't really pull any strings, right? Like other parents.
Well, you're also a UCLA grad. For those of you who are in California, you don't know UCLA and USC, that's a huge rivalry.
I had to bite my tongue quite a bit. I, you know, when he's like, I want to go to USC, I'm like, why? Why dude, that place? But because he has so much grit, this is not conceptual, but I told him, I said, I know you identify right now mostly as white and you're really privileged. And so we've talked about this. This is not, you know, this is not me being harsh. We talked about how privileged he is, despite the fact that he has all this learning differences. We're able to get him help, you know, and he's going to a private high school and, you know, and so he knows he's privileged in that way. And I said, but man, I'm so proud of you. You have so much grit. I said, I've double your grit, but man, I wasn't even expecting this much from you because you grew up so privileged, but I'm so proud of you because you have so much grit. And I think that's the biggest compliment that somebody can give other people. It's like, I recognize your effort, you know, like so much work, you know, and so much fight and determination. That's more than what it is that you've accomplished. It's like you really fought for it, man. And he could have fought for a program somewhere else, you know. And if he fought for it, I would have said the same thing. So yeah, my kids are my badge of honor.
I love it, Hong, that whole growth mindset and instilling that in them at such a young age. I had to change the praise that I would give to my boys, like, oh, you're so smart, you got an A, versus, oh my goodness, Stevie, you worked so hard on that project. It paid off. I am so proud of you. You turned in your best work product that you could. And I think it definitely is helping. My mom has told me this for years. But it takes me listening to the expert in the field to actually implement it. But no, I am right there with you, Hong. Hong, this has been such a pleasure having this great conversation with you. Before we let you go, though, I just need to ask on behalf of our listeners who may find themselves as the first or the only. You've been in that situation countless times. What advice do you give to that person?
I don't think about first and only. I think about walking into a room and doing my best.
Yes.
And also believing that I belong in that room, right? I belong in that room. I remember thinking when I was at Impax, April, you can relate, but so all the senior management at that point, and this is before April came, all the senior management at that point were of men. And they were dressed very conservatively.
A lot of them white men,
except for the CEO. I remember walking in with my hair sticking straight up. And I don't know how it was cut at that point. And basically, you know, in Silicon Valley garb, walking in and having a full-on conversation with them about a litigation that was like a big deal, right? And I remember having this conversation, and I just took one moment and looked around, and I was like, wow, I'm sitting in this room. This is great, you know? I look the way I look. I'm totally out and open, and I can dress how I want, and I can talk the way I want. I think what the only advice that I could give people is just not think of yourself as the first and only to put any pressure on you. Mm-hmm. Think of that as like, hey, I belong there. I'm there. Do your best, and you belong there, because you wouldn't be there if you didn't belong there.
Yes.
You belong there. So just think that way. And then the first and only is only afterwards, right? Oh, I was the first and only. Well, cool. I should have been. You know, I shouldn't have been. But okay, whatever. Move on. You know, like I don't really take a lot of stock in like, or pat myself in the back for being first and only. It's only like, what? Well, why was I? Like, this is not hard.
No, exactly. And the thing is, I will say, as someone who I said is 5 feet tall, you really made it your point to be able to take up space in that room as well.
Yeah.
And your story of how you came to be where you are right now is so inspiring to me personally, and I'm sure to our listeners. And I really can't thank you enough for sharing your story, being your authentic self, and just being really telling your truth to our listeners. So thank you so much, Hong. It's like I said at the beginning, it's really my privilege to be your friend, and thank you.
Thank you, guys. My pleasure to come and have this conversation with you.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed Sidebars, we invite you to check out the Kilpatrick Townsend Medicine and Molecules blog at kilpatricktownsend.com. to read, watch, and listen to other related insight on patent law. We'll also put that information in the show notes. The opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and are not those of Kilpatrick Townsend.
Also, we would love it if you would rate us or leave a review. It helps others find the show. See you next time.